And Radio Derb is on the air with our first podcast of the new decade. Greetings to all from your realistically genial host, John Derbyshire. The end of the holiday season is in sight, says your host, with no small measure of relief. The season goes on a bit longer than usual in the Derb household. After New Year, there is January 5th, our daughter's birthday, and then Chinese New Year, which this year falls early, January 25th. It'll be the year of the rat, in case you're wondering. After that, it's a pretty clear run through to July 4th, unless people remember my own birthday in June, which, on the whole, I'd rather they didn't. OK, what's the mood this first week of the 20s? My own mood is one of deep TDS. Yes, that's Trump Disappointment Syndrome. Permit me to expatiate on that. As a member of Donald Trump's voter base in 2016, I was hoping for two things from him. One, an overhaul of our immigration system to favour ordinary Americans, not foreigners and billionaires, as is currently the case. And two, an end to the imperialist world-saving expeditions of the Clinton, Bush and Obama years. The past 3 years have seen some small hopeful movements on the first item. Some improved border fencing, as I have been dutifully recording, some associated leaning on Mexico to cooperate in controlling the flux from Central America, some slight trimming of our extravagant guest worker programs. Well, I'll have more to say about it all later. We're still playing world saver, though. Instead of minding our own business as a commercial republic, which is what the founders intended and what most Americans would prefer. NATO is still going strong, ready to repel the Soviet tanks as they storm through the Fulda Gap. We are still committed to the defence of South Korea against an adversary with a population half the South's and a GDP 1/50th. And, of course, we're still in the damn stinking, filthy, wretched, worthless Middle East, as if their endless tribal bickering was any of our business. Speaking of a similarly messed up region 140 years ago, Otto von Bismarck remarked that, quote, "The Balkans are not worth the bones of a single Pomeranian grenadier," end quote. I feel the same way about the Middle East, although with GIs in mind, not Pomeranian grenadiers. Where the heck is Pomerania anyway? Never mind. We've all heard about the latest eruption over there. A mob under Iranian direction stormed our embassy in Iraq in retaliation for something we did to them, which was in retaliation for something they did to us, which was in retaliation for something we did to them, which was in retaliation for something they did to us, which was in retaliation for something we did to them, which was in retaliation for something they did to us, which was in retaliation for something we did to them, which was in retaliation for something they did to us, which was in retaliation for something they did to us, which was in retaliation for something we did to them, which was in retaliation for something they did to us. If you follow that chain of causation back far enough, you come to George W. Bush's destruction of the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq, which the cretins in charge of our government imagined would usher in a cordial Jeffersonian democracy there. What it actually did was hand over Iraq to Iran, strengthening the Shia side of the Sunni-Shia regional divide and firing up the resentment of the dispossessed Sunnis. I'll admit I did not foresee this at the time, not knowing or caring a damn about Iraq. Much more to the point, apparently none of our highly paid career foreign policy and military strategists foresaw it either. No wonder Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Bolton and the rest have ever since been total outcasts from society, forced to live in camouflaged huts in the remote mountain west for fear of assaults from outraged citizens. So, here we are, as at Friday afternoon, playing chicken with Iran. If you want to read a thoughtful, well-informed analysis of the situation, I recommend David Goldman's column over at Asia Times. David's writing from the great game point of view. Sample quote. After 5,000 dead, 50,000 wounded, and trillions of dollars in expenditures in Iraq, the US had succeeded in turning a former counterweight to Iranian ambitions into an Iranian satrapy. The embassy attack was intended by Iran as a public act of ritual humiliation, and the United States had no choice but to respond, end quote. Fair enough, if you think we have to keep playing the great game. My own preference would be to tip over the chessboard and walk away. 3 years ago, I would have called that a Trumpian move. Now, I am wiser. Trump doesn't have that kind of audacity. Nor any other kind, really. He's just another damn Republican. Trump disappointment syndrome. Where did I put my medication? Headline here from The Hill. January 1st. Headline. US combat deaths in Afghanistan highest in years. We lost 17 servicemen to enemy action in Afghanistan last year. 14 Army and 3 Marines. For the previous 4 years, working back from 2018 to 2015, the numbers were 13, 11, 9, 10. 17 is nearly double 9. So you could rephrase the data as our Afghanistan combat deaths in Donald Trump's third year were almost twice what they were in Barack Obama's last year. Of the army fatalities, 3 were paratroopers, like my son. Junior left the service when his 4-year term was up in 2017, without having been deployed. If he had re-enlisted, he'd have been in Afghanistan last year with those other paratroopers. What's keeping us in Afghanistan? What's in it for the deep state types? When I ask that about Iraq or Syria, friends and colleagues tell me it's all the Israeli and Saudi money sloshing around in Washington, D.C. No doubt that's something to do with it, but what do the Israelis and the Saudis care about Afghanistan? What does anyone care about the damn place? Normally, at this point, I would launch into a rant about the criminal folly of our Afghanistan policy. I have to confess, though, that on this topic, after so many years, I'm all ranted out. I refer you to my December 13th coverage of the Saigar Report, which I concluded by calling for public hangings of those responsible for our Afghanistan policy. My opinions since then have changed slightly. I'm now against public hangings. Instead, I want these people publicly boiled alive. Here is an immigration-related headline. This one's from Axios.com, December 29th. Headline: US companies are forcing workers to train their own foreign replacements. Whoa, hold on. Did I check the year on that? Was that really December 29th, 2019? Yes, it was. Wasn't this an issue back in the 2016 election? Yes, it was. Didn't candidate Trump promise to address it? Yes, he did.
It's very bad for our workers, and it's unfair for our workers, and we should end it. Very importantly, the Disney workers endorsed me, as you probably read, and I got a full endorsement because they're the ones that said, and they had a news conference, and they said he's the only one that's going to be able to fix it, because it is a mess.
That was a GOP candidates debate in March of 2016, close to 4 years ago. The villain in today's story is not Disney, it's AT&T. Quote from the Axios report: AT&T is poised to send thousands into the new year hunting for new jobs after assigning them to train their own foreign replacements, according to conversations with current and former workers and documents obtained by Axios. Many have worked for the company for over a decade. They aren't being offered severance or early retirement and may not easily find a comparable job elsewhere with similar pay. End quote. On the issue of mega corporations using guest worker visas to bring in cheap foreign labour, replacing American workers, the phrase "eternal recurrence" keeps bobbing up in my mind. It's like the war in Afghanistan. I can look back at commentary from 5, 10, 15 years ago. Nothing's changed. On this one, in fact, things may be about to get worse. VDare.com's Washington Watcher tells us that Senate Bill 386, full title, the Fairness for High-Skilled Immigrants Act, may pass the Senate by unanimous consent next week, without any public hearings. This is the bill that, to put it in a nutshell, fudges up the difference between a temporary guest worker visa, like the notorious H-1B, and a permanent residence green card. The effect of passing S-386 will be, to quote Washington Watcher, the new bill increases the immigrant impact by no longer forcing guest workers to leave. Now an American has to compete with low-paid guest workers who can stay for as long as it takes to obtain a green card. End quote. As I mentioned earlier, there has been some trimming of the number of H-1B approvals. Put that together with this S-386 green card handout, the administration is giving with one hand while taking away with the other. Not what we voted for on immigration, not at all. And still, nothing, no action at all on birthright citizenship, e-verify, visa overstays, chain migration, the green card lottery, or the uniquely horrible CPT and OPT programs. That's curricular practical training and optional practical training. Basically backdoors from student visas, of which we issue far too many, to H-1Bs. I call them uniquely horrible because they not only help to displace American workers, they also shovel funds into the higher education rackets that are already bloated with cash. We need a bold chief executive who will take a flamethrower to the whole rotten, corrupt system of legal immigration, while simultaneously, of course, dealing with illegal immigration by strict enforcement of the people's laws. If only we could get someone like that in the White House. There's a big nationwide trend of easing up on people who've been arrested for the lesser kinds of crime. Easing up on them in the early stages of the criminal justice process, that is. A reminder of those early stages, ignoring some slight variations state to state. At a wrongdoer's first encounter with the police, one of two things happens. Either A, for the most minor offences, he's given a written citation, a signed promise to appear in court when summoned, and then he's let go. Or B, for something more serious, he's taken to the station house for booking, where cops take his picture and his prints, look him up on their computer, go through his pockets, and then lock him in a cell. Then comes a bail hearing. The decision to be made here by a judge is, should the guy be let go on his own recognizance with a promise to appear at court when summoned? Or should he only be let go after depositing a sum of money, that sum to be forfeit if he doesn't show up at court? Or should he not be let go at all, but returned to the cells until his court date? That court date, the one that we're all hoping the guy shows up for, is his arraignment, the first episode of the courtroom drama to decide guilty or innocent. Those are the early stages of the criminal justice process. The easing up trend is mostly on the bail hearing. My own state of New York passed a law last year, taking effect this week, to abolish bail altogether for misdemeanors and non-violent felonies. In anticipation of the new rules taking effect, local judges have been letting people go free who would formerly have been required to post bail. This has led to a rash of lurid stories in local tabloids about perps who are obviously crazy dangerous, but who were set free at their bail hearings. Stephen Haynes, who sucker-punched a cop and wrestled him to the ground last Thursday, was back on the street Friday, notwithstanding a felony assault charge and 24 prior arrests. The poster gal here, though, is 30-year-old Tiffany Harris. Miss Harris slapped three Orthodox Jewish women in the street last Friday while yelling anti-Semitic obscenities at them. She was arrested and booked, but set free at her bail hearing on Saturday. On Sunday, she ambushed another Jewish woman out walking with her three-year-old and a baby. Miss Harris punched this woman in the face. Monday, she was set free again, with instructions to report to a social worker. Miss Harris did report to the social worker, and promptly assaulted her. She is now being held for psychiatric evaluation. Superficially, there is a case for dropping bail requirements. If you're rich, bail is not a problem. If you're poor, it may be. In practice, though, bail is not often arduous, and there are bail bondsmen to help you out. Also, as Seth Baron has pointed out, quote from him, advocates describe a picture of hopelessly poor families unable to scrape together a few hundred dollars to get their loved ones out of jail. They don't talk about families tired of dealing with relatives perennially in trouble with the law. Some may decide that they'd rather see the troublesome relation stay in jail. End quote. A big element of what's going on with these reforms is white race guilt. Here are two assistant district attorneys in chapter 5 of Tom Wolfe's novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities. Quote, every assistant DA in the Bronx, from the youngest Italian just out of St. John's Law School to the oldest Irish bureau chief, shared Captain Ahab's mania for the great white defendant. For a start, it was not pleasant to go through life telling yourself, what I do for a living is I pack blacks and Latins off to jail. Kramer had been raised as a liberal. In Jewish families like his, liberalism came with the Similac and the Mott's apple sauce. And even the Italians and the Irish, who were not exactly burdened with liberalism by their parents, couldn't help but be affected by the mental atmosphere of the law schools, where, for one thing, there were so many Jewish faculty members. So it made the boys uneasy, this eternal prosecution of the blacks and Latins. End quote. I think some of that uneasiness has crept into these new rules for bail. Both of the people I mentioned above, Stephen Haynes and Tiffany Harris, both of them are black. These new rules are part of the never-ending quest for some kind of unfairness, causing the massive disproportion of blacks and the somewhat lesser disproportion of Latinos in our jails. It can't possibly be that there is something intrinsically different about these groups. That is unthinkable. So there must be some kind of unfairness skewing the numbers. We have to find that unfairness and root it out. I mentioned Tiffany Harris slapping and punching Jewish women. There's a lot of that in the streets of New York. Well nigh every day in our news outlets there is some story of blacks attacking Jews. It's gotten so bad the New York Times has editorialized about it. That editorial in the January 3rd issue of the paper is a gem of race denialism. Someone should engrave a copy of it on some durable material and seal it in a time capsule so that people of the future can see what lying cowards the early 21st century American ruling classes were. The editorial mentions some of the crimes. Quote, in Crown Heights, a section of Brooklyn, in August, a Jewish man in his 60s was hit in the face with a brick, breaking his nose and knocking out his teeth. In November, an Orthodox woman and her child were walking in the Borough Park neighborhood of Brooklyn when three boys threw eggs at them. Just weeks later, two Orthodox teenagers were assaulted in Brooklyn. One of them hit in the head, his skull cap removed. End quote. Look at the diction there. You either get the passive voice, was hit, were assaulted, or else you get three boys. A bit later, we are told that, quote, in France last year, thousands took to the streets to protest a sharp rise in anti-Semitic incidents. End quote. Goodness, what could explain rising anti-Semitism in France? Beats my pair of jacks. There's passing mention of the December 10th murders at a kosher supermarket in Jersey City when, quote from the Times editorial, a man and a woman killed three people. A man and a woman. It's also generalised and racially non-specific. Why not go full bore non-specificity and write two featherless bipeds? Race does get an oblique mention, mind. Quote, other incidents appear to have been carried out by young people, sometimes in neighbourhoods with long histories of tensions between Jewish and Black and Hispanic New Yorkers. End quote. It's tensions, you see. Tensions, like two people pulling opposite ends of a rope. Tensions. The Jews are mean to the Nams. The Nams are mean to the Jews. Tensions. And, of course, there are sinister outside forces stirring up this violence. Quote, some people, as always, are seeking to exploit this moment of deep pain. If we allow them to, they will divide us, pushing New Yorkers further behind the tribal lines that have always run through the city. End quote. In the online New York Times, the word some in that last quote, some people, has a hyperlink to a tweet by Rudy Giuliani. You see, it's all the fault of white people. Further quote, in New York, a city of immigrants and refugees, anti-Semitism is a threat to everyone. Just like white supremacy, it flourishes like a plague when cynics and bigots inflame painful divisions and spew hate for political gain. End quote. That first sentence there doesn't make sense. How is anti-Semitism a threat to everyone? It can't be much of a threat to anti-Semites, can it? And who are the cynics and bigots who inflame painful divisions and spew hate for political gain? Why not name the evil ones? I got that link to Rudy's tweet in the online Times, but how are readers of the paper version supposed to figure out who is being referred to? As if they didn't know. Quote, it should come as no surprise, then, that violent hate crimes against other Americans, Black, Hispanic, Muslim, transgender, have also been on the rise in recent years. End quote. Black, Hispanic, Muslim, transgender, huh? Do other Americans get victimized by people with group hatreds? Christians? Old ladies in nursing homes? Asians? Normal, non-sexually confused white people? I guess not. All together now. Repeat after me. Diversity is our strength. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. 2 weeks ago, I mentioned the late Representative John Dingell, the longest-serving ever member of the House. He held his seat, representing suburban Detroit, for 59 years. Now, his wife Debbie holds it. President Trump had a little spat with Debbie Dingell, and that was the occasion of my comment. I didn't know the half of the Dingell story. Before John Dingell held the seat, his dad, John Sr., held it for 22 years. This has been a Dingell seat since 1933. The Dingells are the American equivalent of hereditary aristocrats. They've done well by it, too. When Debbie took over the seat from John Jr. in 2015, her net worth was $3.6 million. Where did it all come from? Check out Daniel Greenfield's December 23rd piece at Front Page Mag. He gives all the grisly details. After laying out some of the corruption and thuggery of the Dingell clan, Greenfield concludes that, quote, America didn't need a single Dingell in her house. It certainly didn't need three. End quote. Item. As we head into the 2020s, a lot of pundits, including me, have been looking back on the 1920s as a decade of fun, frolic, and fast technological progress. Historian Anton Haus has reminded us that the 1820s were pretty nifty too. Technology-wise, I have noted in a previous podcast what an engineering marvel the Erie Canal was, opened in 1825. That same year, over in England, saw the first working steam railroad. Oersted discovered electromagnetism, and Faraday laid the groundwork for electric power generation. It can't be altogether a coincidence that both the 1920s and, at any rate in Europe, the 1820s, both came right after times of war. World War I in the former case, the Napoleonic Wars in the latter. So perhaps here we have the answer to the Seinfeld question. War, what is it good for? Perhaps it's good for bringing forth a decade of fun and creativity. Item. If we needed any further evidence of the utter worthlessness of the Republican Party, we've been getting it in the spectacle of Republican state governors, one after another, lining up to defy President Trump and bring so-called refugees into their states. If you're concerned about thousands of third world grifters being settled in your state, you should follow the fearless Ann Corcoran at the website Refugee Resettlement Watch. Ann's been posting for years on the refugee resettlement money scam, which has very little to do with giving a helping hand to the wretched of the earth, and a great deal to do with lining the pockets of phony non-profits like the Conference of Catholic Bishops, Episcopal Migration Ministries, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, and other reassuringly churchy-sounding outfits, all sucking on the taxpayer teat. The Trump administration, to its credit, has been trying to starve the beast, but it's been meeting a lot of opposition from state governors. Democratic governors, of course. Unemployable third worlders are future Democratic voters. GOP governors are also siding with the racketeers, though. 18 of them at Ann's last count. Here are the cucking states. Arkansas, Arizona, Idaho, Indiana, Iowa, Maryland, Massachusetts, Missouri, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Tennessee, Utah, Vermont, West Virginia. If you live in one of those states, call your governor's office and tell him you have all the third world mooches you need. Genuine refugees, where there are any, are best and most economically helped in countries neighbouring their own. And if churchy organisations want to do good, they should raise funds from their own congregants, not from tax revenues. Item. If you think abolishing ICE is crazy, you don't know how crazy things are getting. The latest fad among the woke is to abolish the police. Yep, you heard it right. Chris Rufo at City Journal has a fascinating piece on it. Sample quote. In Seattle, socialist city council candidate Sean Scott, who ran on a police abolition platform, came within 1,386 votes of winning elected office. During his campaign, he argued that the city must disinvest from the police state and build towards a world where nobody is criminalized for being poor. End quote. How would this work as actual policy? Chris quotes Richard Putz, writing in Socialist Worker. And yes, that's the guy's name, Putz, P-U-T-Z. It's not my fault, that's his name. Mr. Putz says that cities must, quote, help people resolve conflicts through peace circles and restorative justice programs, end quote. Peace circles. Restorative justice. Paging Marianne Williamson. Paging Ms. Williamson. Item. Financing healthcare is one of the greatest challenges in modern statecraft. Here is a new angle on the issue, one I haven't seen mentioned before. This is from the website IFL Science. Headline. Goldman Sachs says curing diseases may not be economically viable. The gist of it is that if we can completely cure chronic diseases, as is increasingly the case, the revenue stream to the company marketing the cure stops with the cure. Worse yet, if it's an infectious disease, once you're cured, you won't be infecting anyone else. So soon, there will be no more curing required. On the other hand, drugs providing long-term management of a disease, not curing it, just keeping it managed, those drugs are much better for the company balance sheet. All this is from a report sent out to clients by Goldman Sachs, a firm that knows a thing or two about finance. If there is a way to square provision of health care with a free market economic model, I haven't seen it. Item. Possibly related, but definitely a leading candidate for the title, headline I never thought I'd see, is this one from the Los Angeles Times, December 25th. Headline. Americans are retiring to Vietnam for cheap health care and a decent standard of living. The Americans in the story are mainly Vietnam vets, I guess because they are the ones who know at least some of the language. What's the appeal of Vietnam? Quote, inexpensive housing, cheap health care, and a rising standard of living. Also a pretty nice climate, I would guess. As Germany and Japan surged ahead economically in the 1950s and 1960s, while Britain sank into post-imperial stagnation, the British adults that I grew up among griped that winning a war wasn't as good a deal as you'd think it would be. As Vietnam now surges ahead, while the streets of America fill up with homeless bums and drug addicts, winning their war against Uncle Sam seems to be working out nicely for the Vietnamese. Item. Every morning I trawl through news websites, bookmarking items I might use in the podcast. Most of them don't get used, but they hang out there in my bookmarks until I clean them up at year end. Doing the cleanup this week, I spotted this one, and I wondered why I hadn't used it. It is so Radio Derb. I think I'm going to make it my story of the year for 2019. This is from Associated Press, September 24th. Headline. Woman bites camel's genitals to escape enclosure at truck stop. So the venue here is a truck stop with a petting zoo in Iberville Parish, Louisiana. A Florida couple were at this truck stop with their pet dog. Dog got into the camel's enclosure. Woman crawled under the fence to retrieve dog. Camel sat on woman. Woman used her teeth on camel's nether parts to free herself. Final graph from the news report, quote, Deputy Louis Hamilton Jr. said the couple provoked the camel and cited them for a leash law violation. The woman also had to be hospitalised. And the camel is doing fine. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening, and a very happy new year to one and all. Radio Derb's sympathies and best wishes to the people of Australia, who are enduring some horrendous heat, drought, and brush fires down there. I know I have listeners in Australia. To all of you, please be safe, hang in there, do what you can to help your neighbours and fellow countrymen. There will be more from Radio Derb next week. Here to sing us out is a great Australian, Peter Dawson.
Forgot and never brought to mind. Should old acquaintance be forgot and days all lang syne? your auld lang syne, my dear, for auld lang syne. We'll take a cup o' kindness yet for auld lang syne. For auld lang syne, my dear, for auld lang syne. We'll take a cup.